We will convene the Monday, May 24th edition of the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Today we are in work session on House Bill 2535. I know some of you have probably come a goodly number of miles, and that this has been a well-covered, somewhat controversial issue through the building as it's traversed the trail to get this far and get to the hopefully get to the floors. I want to compliment everyone involved in this process. I think it's been very forthright. There's been a tremendous amount of public hearing and input on this bill. We are in a work session. It is not open for public testimony. We may invite witnesses up, but quite frankly, even that is somewhat doubtful at this point in time. I think all the major aspects of the bill have been discussed and rediscussed multiple times. I think everyone knows what we're talking about here. So with that, let me turn it over to my absent staff for a quick summary, and we will proceed ahead.
Chair Westland, committee members, before you, placed before you in your stack is the copy of the fiscal impact statement that was developed to respond with the Aid and Growth Bill. Before you today will be presented -810 amendments, which will be spoken to in a minute. The only modification that would be necessary relative to the fiscal impact based on the -810 amendments to the discussion are two things. One, the fiscal impact notes approximately $170,000 in general fund startup costs. That will go away based on the amendments in -810 that allow the Department of State Police to charge an increased fee. The current fee is $10 through May 1, 2000. That will allow them to generate enough revenue to recover the startup costs within the biennium. The only other change is that in the -810 that would be a fiscal impact in nature is that the Department of Administrative Services is in the AVROS version as the body who provides oversight and reporting to the legislature, and the Secretary of State is substituted for DAS. In both of those budgets, they have planned on absorbing the cost of the oversight review and report based on their currently adopted budgets. So, no fiscal impact based on that change.
Okay.
Are there any questions?
Any questions of staff?
Mr. Chairman, one question I do have is, who has the -810 amendment?
Those have been widely circulated. I'm happy to have met the only guy in the building that doesn't have it.
Carry your stack in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody should have those.
Are you giving it in your hand? Amendments are these.
If I may.
Let me, at this juncture, call on Representative Mannix to give us somewhat of a history of how we got here and a recap of the provisions of the bill and what specifically the -10 represents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I will answer Senator Hannah's question first, which is the A-10 amendments are the technical adjustments to the bill which were agreed upon. They've been reviewed by all of the participants and have been agreed upon as correct technical adjustments to the bill as it came out of the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. And we have gone to the opponents and participants to make sure that this language met with their understanding. Mr. Chairman, this bill goes back a ways, but I'll try to wrap this into a fairly brief discussion. The House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law heard a raft of firearms-related bills during what we call Gun Week, and actually it lasted beyond a week, back in March, and we'd said all session that the House would be addressing a number of firearms-related issues. Ultimately, Senate Bill 700 was referred to the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law floor. At that time, I promised that our committee would come out with a bill addressing the issue, and that was an important promise to members on both sides of the aisle. The committee heard Senate Bill 700 and also reviewed House Bill 2535, which was a different approach to the same issue. and we ultimately determined that House Bill 2535 would be the vehicle that we would use. At this point, I'd like to mention that on the Senate side, of course, Senator Burdick was the key proponent of the central issue, which is background checks at gun shows. In the House, Representative Leonard on the floor was very much an advocate for the same issue. A number of us shared the concern about those issues, but also wanted to make sure that some other firearms-related issues were addressed in the same legislation. This composite bill contains what I describe as what anybody would need, but it does not contain what anybody would like. That is, there are more things that people would like to have from various perspectives that are not in this bill, but in terms of an essential package, it addresses what the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law thought was the core set of issues relating to firearms. We did send out separate bills relating to supplemental issues, and we certainly infused the discussion on several other bills beyond those with firearms issues. But this bill addresses the core issues. In that context, I was pleased that our committee, by unanimous vote, sent this bill to the House Judiciary Committee, the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and with a due pass recommendation. And at the time, there was a discussion of the need for some technical refinements, which are reflected again in those A-10 amendments, and a discussion about how they would be blended into the bill. The significant element is a change in the current law from having dealers perform background checks as to purchasers of firearms, using the Oregon system for handguns and using the federal system for long guns, to a system where dealers and citizens all have access to a single source point, which would be the Oregon State Police for background checks, and a requirement that anyone who transfers over 25 firearms in a year or is at a place where over 25 firearms are available for transfer conduct background checks to the Oregon State Police. There is also the availability of that system for anyone, even if the person is transferring only one firearm, to call in and get this background check from the state police by calling a toll-free number. Because of the anticipated increased volume, since we're combining two systems here, the statutory cap on fees for background checks is dropped from $10 to $8.50 over a series of months so that we can drive down the cost a little bit. There is a provision for $1 of the charge to be used towards law enforcement for enforcement of compliance with the firearms laws. As part of this, as an encouragement to citizens, anyone who gets a background check is given immunity from civil liability for any subsequent use of that firearm after they've transferred the firearm. The background check provision has a couple of exemptions, including anyone who is transferring from their own home. That's not covered unless you're in effect, running a gun show at your home. We've got some provisions that address that, but someone who's transferring a firearm from their own home and has their own collection present need not worry that their home suddenly becomes defined as that, because it was written so that wouldn't happen. There's also an exemption for estate sales involving a single estate, because we are advised in some rural areas, sometimes a single estate may contain a number of firearms, and there's an exception in the law for that. The other significant elements have to do with protection of children. There is a provision that says that anyone who acquires a safety device, that is a trigger lock or a lock box or safe for storing a firearm, and uses that device, is given immunity from civil liability if anyone overcomes that security device and causes harm. So that's an encouragement to folks to purchase such devices and to use them. I had mentioned there are two separate bills having to do with tax incentives. Those went to the Revenue Committee for their deliberation. Beyond that, there is a provision that if someone has a child under the age of 15 in the home, that it is a violation to leave a loaded firearm in that person's presence where it's accessible to that person with no adult supervision, if that person, that child, then uses the firearm within the next 24 hours to kill or injure somebody. In those circumstances, that is a violation subject to a penalty. That's to create the concept that it is inappropriate, it's illegal, to leave a loaded firearm in the presence of a loaded, unsecured firearm in the presence of a child without adult supervision. The other elements of the bill are somewhat technical, but address a wide range of issues confronting firearms owners. Right now, the concealed handgun permit process allows a permit for 4 years. The bill allows it to run from 4 years from your next birthday, make it an more easily remembered renewal date, but also gives a little extension of time there. There's a provision for citizens from non-contiguous states to be able to apply for concealed handgun permits if they meet the standards of Oregon law and if they have a nexus in Oregon as to business or family interest. And then the sheriff has the discretion to provide those permits. There's also provision for police reserve officers with authorization from their appointing authority to carry concealed handguns without having to get a permit, just as regular police officers have that. I'll stop there because I could probably go through a dozen other detailed provisions, but that gives you the flavor of some of the balancing pieces that have been put into this. I will mention one other thing. Right now, it's a Class A misdemeanor for an otherwise law-abiding citizen who happens to have a handgun on their person without a permit. This changes that to say that if you have a concealed handgun, but you have no criminal record and you're not engaged in criminal activity and you happen to be found with this concealed handgun, that on your first offense, in effect, that will be dropped down to a violation, which is not a criminal offense. It's subject to a fine. The next time, it becomes a misdemeanor again.
Very good. Thank you for that concise report.
Could I ask Representative Mannix, I'm just looking at my concealed handgun license. It expires May 2000. You said it's from your birthday 4 years. Is that from my birthday this year or my birthday next year?
It's 4 years from, well, if you have one up for renewal, when you apply for renewal, it's 4 years from whatever the next birthday will be. So it's always going to be longer rather than shorter time.
Okay, so I was looking at your provisions in here in the House Bill 2535, where you ended, added also 1 year from the next birthday of the licensee, if the license is issued under to a resident of a non-contiguous state or territory in the United States. So if somebody has a concealed weapons permit from another state, they can be issued a license up to a year.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this has to do with residents of, residents of contiguous states around Oregon can get a concealed handgun permit for 4 years. This allows the contiguous state residents to get it for 4 years from their next birthday. For non-contiguous states, there's no process at all for anyone to apply for and get a permit. This allows all the rest of the persons in the United States to apply and get a one-year permit. The position of the sheriff was it's harder to keep track of anyone's criminal activity if they did get in trouble further away from Oregon, but that with a 1 year, it's 1 year from your next birthday. With that provision, persons from further away can get that, but it's not because they have a concealed handgun permit from another state. It's because they applied in Oregon and met the Oregon standards. They have to get an Oregon permit. There is another provision, if I may, in answering that question, where you can come into the state, and if you're intending to become a resident, you may apply for an Oregon concealed handgun permit and get a temporary permit from the sheriff while that permit application is pending, so you can have some continuity of coverage.
Very good.
Ready for a motion?
Well, first thing you need to do is accept the dash cam amendment as so moved.
So moved.
Okay, I think everyone has a copy of the dash 10. Distributors, anyone not gotten a copy of the dash 10? Okay, we have a motion before us to amend House Bill 2535 with the amendments as represented by the dash 10. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Schroeder.
One of the technical things that they changed the purchaser to transferee, is there a reason for that?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, there are times when people simply give someone a firearm, and this expands it so that when you're giving someone a firearm, over 25 actually, that you would also do the background check. So you don't say, well, I gave this stranger the gun, so I didn't need to do the background check. No, you needed to do the background check if you're otherwise required to do so.
Paul, second question. just perhaps I'm not tracking real well, but on page 3 of the dash cams, it's been in earlier amendments too, that there's a reference to 166.414, and then again later on in section 23 on page 4, so another reference is a reason to do that.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, it's a very confusing way that legislative council does this, but in effect we adopt a fee schedule and then we disadopt it until the new fee. We're trying to have a 7-month $10 fee schedule. Thereafter, it's permanently $8.50. So you have to adopt the $8.50, and then you also separately adopt the $10 as a substitute, and that's why you have it come up twice. Once it's the $8.50, the $8.50 will be the permanent provision.
I guess with the special we were talking about earlier, phase it in, so it would be.
Any other discussion on amending House Bill 2535 with the dash 10 amendments? Any opposition to amending House Bill 2535 with the dash 10 amendments? Seeing none, it is so moved.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir, yeah.
I would move House Bill 2535 to the floor, or to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
As amended?
As amended.
Any discussion? Representative Patrick.
Mr. Chair, I've expressed to the chair and the chair of the subcommittee my substantial problems with this bill as put together. I feel like I'm somewhat tied because we're in Ways and Means and not dealing with the substantive portion of this legislation. I feel that Representative Mannix has done a yeoman's job trying to do it, but I think that there's some large problems with this bill. My first and foremost problem with this bill is it now switches not only handguns, but long guns to the Oregon records check system. Oregon's records check system under this bill charges $10 now, will be reduced to $8.50 once this measure is put in effect. Currently, under federal law, federal firearms dealers are allowed to use a federal firearms check system in which there is no charge for a background check. They do an NCIC check, which is basically what's done here. The only additional part we do here is mental health. I don't know if that could be included in the federal check or LEDS could post that on the system that they have available. But it's going to place a substantial burden not only on gun dealers that are out there in the community, but it's also going to place a burden on individuals who want to buy firearms at $8.50. The reason we went to the InstaCheck system, if you look at the history of what happened in Oregon, the reason we went to the InstaCheck system was to deal with the issue surrounding how we could to avoid a waiting period on gun legislation that existed for lawful individuals who wanted to have access to firearms. That compromise was struck earlier on. Then the federal background check system came into effect. What I would say is it's available at the federal level. The feds are paying for it now. They do it for free. I don't think we should continue to burden the law-abiding gun owners of the state of Oregon to have to pay additional taxes on firearms when I don't see anything that I've been able to garner, any substantial pieces that we gain by having it just here in Oregon. I think in terms of allowing the individuals to check through an Oregon type of system is good because the federal system doesn't allow for that, but people who are dealers and other firearms people out there should be allowed to continue to use the federal firearms InstaCheck system. In addition, I think that there's a lot of technical problems with this piece of legislation. One of the things that I've mentioned to the committee on page 2,
this is the bill of the 810.
This is the this would be a engrossed version.
I have Representative Mannix marked up version of the bill.
I don't know which version he marked it up from. I have page 2, lines 32 through 35, in regards to dealers and the time lag that it takes to notify the gun dealer that the purchaser that the purchaser is okay. The state police have to come through within a certain amount of time, otherwise the gun dealer can't release the firearm. I think we have a duty to protect people's Second Amendment rights. In regards to the piece that's allowed for individuals, that piece is not included for individuals. And especially if we're doing this at gun shows, those of us who've been to gun shows before know that they may last a day or 2 days. If they have substantial delays in the amount of time that it takes, those individuals will not be able to buy or sell firearms at a gun show, and that provision is not included, though it is included for dealers. In addition, in regards to the retention of records that's available, I think that our bill falls in contradiction with the Brady Law that was presented before the federal government. I think that we're subject to some liability or some form of lawsuit under our records retention piece, not only because it violates BATF rules, but also Prince versus the United States, which is the United States Supreme Court case in 1997. I believe there are some problems there. In regards to that also, I think it creates a problem with interstate commerce in regards to requiring Oregon gun owners to pay a gun tax of $8.50 versus some of our surrounding states who allow records checks to be done through their system, especially for those of us who live in bordering states. I think that that's important that our gun dealers and individuals have the ability to remain competitive. They're still doing the background check, and it accomplishes what was intended to accomplish. And also, I have under Section 5, if the firearm is not transferred from the person to the purchaser within 24 hours after receipt of the unique approval number, a new inquiry must be made by the person. I was trying to find that in Representative Mannix's amendments, but I don't know where it is. It doesn't say what kind of new inquiry. I assume that that's a new inquiry back to the Department of State Police. In addition, I guess I would direct the committee to some of the substantive changes that I see that's being made in regards to unlawful possession of a firearm being a Class A misdemeanor and then reducing it to a violation on the first offense. Being someone whose family has gun dealerships, as well as being someone who came from a district attorney's office in the state, I object to loosening up those firearm requirements. Oftentimes, this may be a first offense, and you're going to find these individuals lurking outside of areas where they get stopped by a police officer because just a freak contact, and they may have a firearm. Maybe about to commit a crime, and I think that that's a problem. We have first-time offenders. Most of the people we see in the system are multiple-time offenders, but we have to give them a violation the first time so they can go back and hurt someone again later. So I have a problem with that. In regards to Section 16, on page 16, I would direct your attention to little A, a locked commercial trigger guard in place. Obviously, this was written by people who are not familiar with firearms. A trigger guard is the piece of metal that goes around your trigger. It is not the, I'll draw on the board, not a very good order. But, this is your firearm. This is your trigger right here. This is a trigger guard. Okay? That's not a trigger lock, that's what I believe was intended by the framers of this this piece of legislation. I believe that that's a substantial problem, especially when we're charging someone with a criminal offense of unlawful storage of a firearm. In addition, line B, placing the firearm in a locked storage device with the key kept in a separate place means that at the gun safe that I have at my house, that wouldn't be a device in which I would fall under keeping it in a locked storage device because it doesn't have a key. It has tumblers on it. I think we need to be very specific when we're passing criminal offenses. That occurs again in several other places. Storage container, commercial trigger guard. These things are not clear, and we're submitting people to criminal liability or possible civil liability as a result of these things not being clear. I think that piece of it is poorly crafted. And finally, I have substantial concern about the emergency clause that's being proposed on the amendments, which is the First Amendment in our A-10 version. That is in regards to the emergency clause. That means that if voters chose to refer it to the people, if they went out and gathered signatures, just like the marijuana initiative happened last time, that would not be allowed with this emergency clause being a part of the bill, and I'm opposed to that. So for those reasons, I'm going to vote against this bill. I think this bill needs some more substantive work. I think that there's other ways that we can avoid some of these taxes, still accomplish the protection of public safety, and that's about it.
Representative Patridge, you and I have had several discussions on those very points, and I just want to emphasize a great deal of what you're saying. I compliment you on your analysis of the bill. We'll just get into it. Any other discussion on the bill?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to give a courtesy vote to get this out of committee, mainly for the reason that it is a Ways and Means Committee, not a Policy Committee, and as Mr. Patrick alluded to, it does have some fiscal, very little, and it looks like that has been taken care of, so I will go for it out of here. But I do ask for that. I haven't made my mind up yet, but I see it as a Senate bill and Senate bill 700. So I will give you a courtesy vote to get it out of here.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hinn.
Ditto for both Representative Paul Pitch and Senator Chen's comments. I'll gladly give you a vote for courtesy, but it doesn't quite extend to the floor.
I think a good number of people have and are walking over coal to get this bill to the floors, and I appreciate each and every one of you. Mayor Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Normally speaking, you can count on me for a courtesy vote as well on this bill because it does have some serious problems from my perspective. However, as the author of Senate Bill 700, I feel I have a special obligation to make sure that whatever gun law passes through this legislature has a credible system for doing the job that Senate Bill 700 did, which was requiring criminal background checks at gun shows. I saw this bill. I gladly put Senate Bill 700 to be put aside in preference for this bill. It's a more comprehensive approach than Senate Bill 700 was. And I commend Representative Mannix for the work he's put in on this. He has developed a fine product. The reason I can't vote for this bill today is because of the sanctions that it provides for violations of the gun check provision at gun shows. People who are required to perform background checks at gun shows under this bill would face a mere violation. Now that's in comparison to people who misuse the public records or the criminal records themselves. They get a criminal conviction, a Class A misdemeanor, whereas people who sell guns to people who might go out and kill a police officer or somebody else, they only get a violation. Now, even Senate Bill 700 had a Class A misdemeanor for violations of the background check provision. Class A misdemeanors appear throughout Chapter 166. It's the normal sanction for violation of a gun law. And Representative Patridge pointed out that he himself opposes lowering that to violation. However, I would feel comfortable, because this is a new system, I would feel comfortable keeping the violation for a first offense. But for beyond the first offense, for second and subsequent offenses, I feel that it's unreasonable to just continue to give people a slap on the wrist rather than getting serious when it's clear that they are doing so intentionally. And I will have to say that there's widespread agreement in the law enforcement community, in the governor's office, in some parts of the gun lobby, that this makes sense. It's reasonable. It gives deference to people who might actually do it by mistake, and yet it really hits the person who sells intentionally to people who are not legally qualified to have guns. So I oppose it for that reason. I'm having amendments drafted, and I will seek to get those amendments. This has been a long and twisted road for this bill. I will seek any chance I get to fix that problem with this bill, and I will work with my colleagues here, even if they are not willing to vote for this bill, to at least recognize that it makes sense on a second offense where someone shows their clear intent to break the law, that we should throw the law right back at them. So normally I would be a courtesy vote. I feel a special responsibility, so I will be voting no.
Senator Brody, perhaps above all else, everyone else, I compliment you on your efforts and your diligence on this subject. I know it's a heartfelt passion of yours, and it has been a long and tortured road. So this is not something that has been arrived at lightly or cavalierly with regard to any particular points of the bill that you agree or disagree with. I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're coming with, coming from. This is as good as we've got and what we're going to get. So, again, people are walking over hot coals.
I appreciate your role, particularly, Mr. Chairman. I know this is not an easy job for you, as it is. It's not an easy job for anyone on this issue.
You know, what I'm worried about is I'm looking around for someone to carry it to full, and I'm afraid where that responsibility is going to fall. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozanski.
I'd like to just clarify a couple of things I heard on the record, and I just want to make sure that the record's clear, at least from my perspective. I think the Oregon InstaCheck is a very important component, because not only does it pick up on mental checks, it also arrests records which are not covered within the federal system. So I think it's another surety to make certain that the individual does check out and verify that they are eligible for gun ownership. And under the Section 14, talking about the CCW, concealed weapons permit, where a person is unlawfully carrying, that if the officer finds that they're engaged in other activity at the time they're engaged in carrying a weapon, that in itself can be a sufficient grounds for them to move forward. That law provides. I guess most importantly, though, because I don't know how many emails I've received about everyone concerned about their Second Amendment rights. And I guess what I would say is I wish everyone had a little bit better civics as to not only the Second Amendment rights, but what's provided for within our own state constitution. And this is where everyone, I guess, notice or information, you may want to look at the Article 1, Section 27, which actually gives Oregonians more rights regarding bearing arms than the Second Amendment does. And I think it's really important that we all realize what our state has provided as an independent document that people within Oregon have. And that's basically, they do in fact have not only the right to bear arms, but also for the defense of themselves. And nowhere in the Second Amendment does that give them that federal right. So I hope that people will realize that we should be protecting our Oregon Constitution instead of lockstepping it into the federal Constitution. And for a little bit of levity, if you look at the drawing up there, we notice that that weapon does need a trigger lock because the trigger's backwards.
I'm highly dyslexic. Keep your day job, buddy.
I told you I was a bad artist, Mr. Chair.
Well, not only that, he drew that, I'm embarrassed to admit this, he drew that picture for me a couple hours ago, and he drew it the same way, and I didn't catch it. So,
I'm partially responsible, I guess, for my good colleague from Medford embarrassing himself in public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any other discussion on a very serious bill? This has been a long, as Senator Burdick indicated, this has been a long road, and I want to compliment each and every person involved in the process. Russ Spencer, Kevin Campbell, John Helen, Bob Schmidt, Rod Harder, Representative Manning, Senator Burdick. There's been lots of people that have done very large and very small things, most of which at some level or another were distasteful to them or they didn't completely agree with. This is a bill that has lots of things for everyone to like and dislike in it. So this has been a difficult process, and again, I compliment each and every one. If there's no further discussion,
I just did a couple of comments, if I may, Mr. Chair. Must be a good piece of legislation because no one's completely satisfied with it. That usually is a hallmark of serious compromise and serious hard work by members. I think it's important for the public to know, that there's not in some pretty good support from the law enforcement community. They've pretty well signed off on this. The organ donors have felt that this is an adequate point to be at this point in time, and even the National Rifle Association said, hey, this may not be their cup of tea, but they're not going to run out there, especially in light of the things that have happened here in our state and other states around the country with young children. The reality is that we have to work within the confines of this legislature, and I'd rather develop this piece of legislation here with all the tremendous people and players that we do have than have some initiative go out there, be written poorly, and then do some real serious damage to our gun owners' rights or to the children of the state. So I think this is the vehicle, and I'm sure on the Senate side, if there's any modifications, they'll do so and do a good job. Wise words. Any further discussion? If not, we'll have the staff call the roll.
Senator Kins.
Aye.
Senator Hannon.
Aye.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Representative Schrader.
Aye.
Representative Manning.
Aye.
Representative Minnis.
Aye.
Representative Krasinski.
Aye.
Representative Pappage.
No.
Representative Shea Westland.
Aye.
Measure passed. Notice we had the bookends. Voting no.
That's good. It's well contained, well crafted.
Perfect. With no measures declared passed, and we will move it to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation. Anyone, you don't all have to leave. I mean, we're going to hear the Department of Corrections now, and it's a very scintillating subject. Anyone want to volunteer to carry this in full committee?
I was afraid of that. I could see that coming from here to La Pine.
Okay. Committee, thank you. Thank you, thank you. Senate, we need a Senate carrier.
Can we appoint one later?
Four carrier. I think we can find
one. I think you can find one in the whole committee. Full way to meet committee. You can find the Senator Carroll in there.
Senator Hannon?
No.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Kim?
Make it at full. At full, you're fine at full. Sonny is carrier. Can you get the full committee for Senate?
Yeah.
Okay. And on the House, we'll have Representative Manning.
Sure.
Hey, good job. Seriously. Jenny?
And I'm not giving up.
Yeah. Well, not only is the audience leaving.
Committee is too.
Hey, we're still in work session here. We could do some interesting stuff. We will adjourn the work session on House Bill 2535. And tap in the public hearing, Department of Corrections Budget, Senate Bill 5506.
Thank you, sir.
Good.
Jenny Pierce Measure.
Staff want to say,
just in the way of helping us in our transition through today's agenda, we have gone past several units today. Before you is the department to talk about the inmate work program. And I'd ask you to just look at the overview carefully. This is one of the major areas that took a significant reduction in the governor's revised budget related to work crews. And we'll need to talk about the impact of that as we go past that budget unit. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bill.
Bill, why don't you proceed ahead, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. And your staff is about to hand out my worksheet for this particular decision. The inmate work programs, the governor's revised budget for this division is $3.8 million general fund, which is a 53.3% reduction from the 97-99 budget approved budget. The total fund budget of $48.7 million is a 14.2% increase from the budget approved. This budget eliminates general fund for 40 work crew supervisor positions. It establishes a mobile work camp for forest health and restoration and approves establishment of new positions for business development. Starting point for this budget was $7.9 million general fund and $41.9 million total funds. The only emergency board was a salary increase. Current service level includes position and inflationary cost increases, startup funding for the Women's Prison and Intake Center and for the Two Rivers Correctional Institute in Umatilla, and elimination of a small amount of unneeded empty limitation for attorney general costs. Program packages, package 90, eliminates 40 work crew supervisors and reduces service and supplies. 19 of the positions supervise institutional work crews in the different prisons. 8 are vacant farm to other funds in the current millennium. 11 are dedicated to parks and recreation department projects, and 2 are dedicated to military department projects. The reduction is $5.9 million general fund and 40 FTE. Package 92, as you've seen before, delays the opening of the Women's Prison Intake Center until the 2001-2003 biennium. Package 95 is a reduction in startup for Two Rivers Correctional Institution. It shifts the cost of the commercial laundry equipment that will be acquired there, the certificates of participation revenues, and eliminates remaining startup funds. The result is a reduction of $1.2 million general fund and $133,000 total fund. Package 110, restore inmate work program positions. This asks for approval of administrative actions taken to reorganize the inmate work programs unit during the 97-99 biennium under authority granted by the 97 legislature. During the interim, 40 positions were established, 16 were reclassed, and 13 were abolished. We're asking you for specifically $1.2 million other funds and 10 positions, 10 FTE. Package 111, inmate work education compliance, creates work program coordinators at 9 existing institutions and establishes an 80-inmate mobile camp for work in forest health and restoration in central and eastern Oregon. That's $3 million other funds and 21. There is no governor's revise for this budget. There are a few technical adjustments. The first is for unintended reductions in services and supplies to the inmate work crews, because it took more than they intended to take there. It establishes service supplies expenditure limitations for new positions, corrects errors in estimated cost of new positions, transfers one position to the institution position with no increase in cost, and corrects errors in small errors in revenue accounts in the inmate work programs. The result of these adjustments increases general fund by $709,000, reduces other funds by $318,000, and eliminates the position. What's missing from the 97-99 legislative budget primarily is the 40 work crew supervisors, and we've got no governor's investment issues here.
Any questions for Josh?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Bill, package 090, the program reduction eliminates the 40 work crew supervisors and reduces services and supplies. 11 of these positions are dedicated to parks and recreation. Who is going to be responsible for using inmate labor out in parks if you do away with these 11 positions?
Mr. Chair, the department's expectation that it would provide crews to parks as available with based on the overall work need for general funded positions, to the extent that Parks is able to hire crews with their own cash, there would be positions that would be available for them. This elimination is just the positions that were specifically funded with general fund for Parks.
Mr. Chairman, we're dealing with, we actually sent out State Parks and encouraged them to cooperate. And ODOT, I think we're working on that as well as a recommendation to cooperate using inmate labor. And then if we cut back all these supervisors, who's watching the inmates? And then there's going to be a tragic occurrence occurring. You can screen them and filter them till hell freezes over, but it only takes one person to get a crack through the system, and we're going to say, well, why weren't there adequate staffing levels out there in the community watching these people even though they're working? If you want to require Parks to increase their funding to buy this service, strange I didn't see at the Parks and Recreation hearing asking for a budgetary authority to fund those positions so you can buy those systems from corrections. I think Parks and Recreation said, we don't want to be corrections officers. They'll provide their own staff people. Now you're telling us you're not going to support it. And it's catch 22 here as far as I'm concerned. And it makes no sense at all.
Mr. Chair, I think just a clarification on this issue. With the elimination of supervisors, the crews would not go out of supervisors. This would also be an elimination of crews as well, or opportunities for inmates to work. I understand your other issues regarding the parks department.
How many do you have total? How many supervisors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, in our presentation today, we have a section on that. Maybe it would be helpful for us to start out and go through the total number of work crews and what the impact would be for the 40 FTEs.
Well, the good representative from Salem brought a budget note in the Ways and Means Transportation Subcommittee that directed the Parks and Recreation to expand the use of inmate labor to the tune of about $1 million. And so if we're expanding it to the tune of $1 million and we're cutting back on this, it sounds like you will only make work crews available whenever you can, or Parks and Recreation has to buy the service. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think probably the best way to handle this with your permission would be to have Michael go through, Michael Tate, Administrator of Inmate Work Programs, go through all of our work crews and talk to you about what our plans are for accommodating the 40 FTE.
Stop everything. We have a gross violation of protocol.
Oh, no.
Yes, we do.
Have you recognized your mistake?
Mr. Chair, I have indeed. Sir.
Before you embarrass us, go to the corner.
Not that again. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. And to my right is Michael Tate. He's the Administrator of the Inmate Work Program.
Well, we'll give him a chance.
I'll do it right when he starts to talk.
Oh, withhold further questions. Well, that's okay, because that's a good line of questioning. We're going to have to get into that in this committee at some point in time.
It sounds like one of those put and take issues, and I'm not sure if we're continually to put it. I think we're taking it. And I want to have some real serious dialogue on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, and yet at the same time, there's value being provided, even if they've got a charge. I mean, there's value being provided. $450 a day, you get 10 guys out there working even at minimum wage. I mean, they're getting some value. A couple ways to slice the apple. It's something we've got to get to the bottom of.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, then with your permission, I'll go through, make our presentation very quickly and let you understand the overall program, and then I'm certain that we'll be able to deal with Senator Hannon's individual concerns. But I think it's a very complicated issue, the interplay of other funds and the program direction. So I think if we can talk about the overall context and then bore down on that issue, I think we can handle most of those questions.
We'll carve off some time, but Representative Schrader, just a request that in the course of the presentation, made on package 110, I'm not familiar what the direction was in 97-99, and we're reorganizing why we need 10 more people to be more effective.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll continue then. The inmate work programs really is the department's major approach to the issue of Measure 17, and it affects a number of different pieces. You've got the industry's programs, which constitute about 8% of the inmate work hours worked. You've got work crews, the ones that the Senator Hannon was just talking about, that portion of it, and that constitutes also about 8% of all the hours worked by inmates. And then we have private partnerships, which are growing, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. That's about 3% of the inmate hours worked are comprised of partnerships with individual companies. That's a section that's growing rapidly, and we'll talk about that in a few moments. The remaining compliance really does come about. The overwhelming majority of the hours worked in the inmate work programs are comprised of inmates running our institutions, about 60% of them or so. I'm starting out for your information as well on C7. In our book is our Section C tabbed inmate work program. The mandates of Measure 17 really alter the very fabric of the way these institutions operate. The work programs predated Measure 17, of course, but it really has altered the way that we define security, the way that we construct prisons. It basically changed most of what we do in one way or another. We run businesses within the walls. We run the work crews, as we talked about, and some of the businesses include laundries, telephone call centers, computer-aided mapping, printing, mailing, the contracted labor. In short, we do lots and lots of different things. It's a very complicated business. The running business within state government, you'll find all the normal features that you would expect to find in any other business. We've got the fiscal office, that people who have to pay the bills, do the things that you would expect. We've got production managers and supervisors. You've got sales, marketing. You've got warehousing functions. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's a very large, complicated operation. The inmate work crews are an important feature. They're very important to the communities, but they represent a relatively small percentage of what the overall efforts are in the inmate work programs.
Ben, how many work crew supervisors did you have when Battle Measure 17 passed?
When it passed back in 1994, Representative Wilson.
94?
April of 94. Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson, I can't tell you exactly how many people were supervising work crews at that time. I could go back and dig it up for you, but I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Yeah, if you could get that. And what's the rationale for keeping so many general fund work crew positions, you know, assigned to inside the walls for inside work crews?
Mr. Chair, when you consider the amount of compliance that we have to get and when you consider the payoffs for running businesses, it technically speaking is a lot more efficient to run inmates, to run businesses inside the walls. You can use medium security inmates, for example. If you put inmates out in crews of 10, you obviously have to have minimum custody inmates only. You have to move them around in the community. You've got a ratio of 10 to 1, one supervisor for 10 inmates. It's relatively inefficient. And it's also very expensive. $400 a day is actually quite a lot of money. I think that there's a misperception by the public that inmate work is cheap. When you move inmates around the community in groups of 10, it really isn't cheap. So if you think about running the institutions, if you think about overall compliance, if you think about generating the skills among inmates and making money, there are a lot of opportunities in creating those businesses inside the wall.
Sure, Hans.
So, in other words, what you're telling us, you're going to have inmate labor keeping inside the wall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I wouldn't say it quite that way. There's a huge public benefit to be had by using inmate crews, fighting forest fires, doing reclamation, rehabbing schools. All of those are very important functions, and I think the Department of Corrections is in a good position to do that, but it's not without a cost. I think there's a huge embedded policy issue there, and that is to what extent will the state subsidize that kind of effort for public works, and it's good public works, and it's important work, and it's good for inmates because they're giving something back to the community, but it does cost something.
But in 090, you're eliminating 40 positions. In 110, you're restoring back some of those positions. Is that right, or are these two different programs?
For the record, my name is Michael Page.
Michael, this is not a difficult thing to do. And if you could take Ben home and just, you know, in front of the mirror thing. Excuse me, Michael.
Michael Page, Administrator of the Inmate Work Program for the Department of Corrections. Chair Westland and Senator Hannon, in answer to your question, Senator Hannon, the folks in Package 110 are not correctional officers. The reduction in 90 are correctional officers, so there are different sets of folks doing different functions for the Department of Corrections.
If a work crew were out in, say, Kelemet Forest, and an occurrence were to occur, does the correctional officer have the authority to arrest or take legal action against an inmate that is acting out?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Well, say we have a work crew and they're working for the Parks and Recreation over at Tenement Forest. And say an inmate starts to act out and you have 10 inmates on the work scene and one corrections guard. Is that corrections guard empowered to arrest or take adequate means because they bridle that one person's action while at the same time having remaining jurisdiction over the 9, or does the corrections officer tell the parks employee, here, you wipe these employees and keep them in line while I chase down my inmate here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, our employee, our correctional officer, does have the authority to maintain control and security of the group. It's hard to say exactly what that strategy would be, but yes, they have the authority to control that group. If your question is, to what extent does a non-DOC person have the authority to do the same thing, their authority is much more limited than DOC's. Now, a couple of different times during the committee, we talked about the relative benefits and training for those, for non-DOC employees, and there's a large policy issue there. Non-DOC employees, we believe, should have the same level of training, and it's something that we really have to take a look at. They won't have the same level of authority.
Well, then, package 110, where you're adding back some of these people, they're non-DOC employees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, they're non-correctional officer employees.
Non-correctional officers.
Yes, sir.
And they have jurisdiction over inmates working?
I'm not exactly sure which positions they are.
Package 110.
Chair Westland, Senator Hannon, those individuals would not have that responsibility on a daily basis. The functions and visions for their positions are other than supervising them.
But it could include
it. It could include supervision, yes.
So you're getting back to your point is having non-correctional officers not trained and in a responsible position. Is that characterization right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, there is a difference in the level of training right now, at least in the time that training is offered to DOC versus non-DOC work crew supervisors. The difference is 40 hours total training for DOC employees versus 8 hours for non-DOC employees. Now, if you think only of the security pieces of the 40 hours, I don't know exactly how much of that is security, but it is true that the training levels are different, and it's really something that we need to take a look at. We've been offering this training now for a year or two, about a year, and it's time to do an assessment of the effectiveness of that training and really take a look at whether or not we ought to amp that training up for non-DOT supervisors. I'd just like to point out for the record again, Mr. Chair and Senator Hannon, that these are minimum custody inmates that we're talking about.
I've heard that over and over, but it only takes one event, and it's one too many. If something happens, no matter how money the person is out there, I'll tell you, maybe you want to catch the public draft, but I sure as hell don't. And I'm not going to play matches with this thing and then assume that everything's taken care of. It's out of sight, out of mind. Don't have to worry about it until it occurs. And then all hell's going to break loose in this state. And why weren't you watching this closer? Why weren't you maintaining control over this? Why weren't you doing something more to adequately, you know, that guard or ranger over there at the coast? That guy wasn't supposed to be dangerous either. You know, he's out on parole. So, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. These people may be minimal sentences, but you don't know when some person's going to flip out on you. And if you only have one guard, let me ask you this question then. If you only have one guard and one park ranger, and the guard turns his back to walk the inmate crew, say two or three of the ten, down here to the south end of the park to work, and the park ranger's managing the other seven up at the north end of the park, and something happens with the inmate on the north crew, not the south crew, but the, it flips out for whatever reason. What's that park ranger supposed to do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I would expect that the park ranger would ask for assistance, either on the radio or ask for help. It wouldn't be reasonable to have a park ranger handle a dispute if it involved more than one inmate. By and large, the issues that we would expect on work crews, and I agree with you, you can't predict human behavior, but the biggest issues that we expect to contend with is walkaways. People actually, minimum custody inmates walking away from the job site.
Who would be liable if the inmate walked away and he was under the direct supervision of the park ranger versus the corrections officer that was off site because he was tending to some other inmates? Would the park ranger get the blame for the person taking a hike?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I'm not an expert in this area, but I would assume the DOC would remain responsible for the safety of the work crews.
You know, Ben, my problem was inmate labor. I don't mind if they're working in a congested area, but you want some of the reports I've heard from some of these park rangers is that there's nothing to preclude or prevent them from working a long stretch, maybe a quarter of a mile long. When you stretch out 10 people a quarter of a mile long, and you lose a sight and control and what have you in that circumstance. And I'm sorry I'm so hell-bent on looking at this, Mr. Chairman, but I really feel this is a real legitimate issue because I don't want one occurrence to occur if there's something we could have done to prevent it.
Well, begs the other question. We've laid, 40, not laid off, but there's going to be a reduction of 40 supervisors. How many does that leave? When it's all said and done? You cut 40 out, and maybe it's right in front of my face, and I'm just not seeing it.
I could clarify. I think this triennium they have approximately 69 general funded work crew positions, and I believe this 40 will really reduce them down to 29. There are a number of other funded positions that are out there. However, their ability to maintain those and keep them filled will be linked to the available revenue from those customers who have the ability to pay for those. So it does a corresponding thing. It reduces not only the number of positions that are eligible to supervise, but it reduces the ability to get inmates out.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask the representative from Salem a question as the sponsor of Salamanca 17? If we retreat from these positions, are we retreating from the position to have more inmate labor out working on the corrections field?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, and be my position that we are. And the theory of the retreat is, the question is whether or not we substitute something else for it, which I've been endeavoring to do by working with a variety of, looking at natural resources, also looking at the parks arena as areas where we could identify particular projects where we could have corrections going to work. But the rationale for this pullback is financial. And then when you evaluate that rationale, you find it's based on false assumptions. I've routinely pointed out that the benefit gained, the value of the project, outweighs the dollar cost. The problem is the way that the executive branch has accounted for this is to only look at the dollar spent and then to say, well, we're losing money on this. And, for instance, the city, to give you one example that's very precise, the city of Salem has made it clear that it would cost them $800 a day to have a 10-person work group, whether they hired or contracted it out, to do parks maintenance. They have had DOC work crews, 10 inmate work crews to do this, and it cost the city $400. From the city's perspective, they just saved taxpayers $400. The Department of Corrections, on the other hand, will tell you that it just cost the taxpayers $400 to have inmates working. Well, in other words, just looking at the fact that $400 was spent, and the DOC, I have to stop here and say, wait a minute, DOC got 400, and I'm giving you the wrong figure. I have to back up for a minute. My recollection is DOC was saying that their crews actually cost more than the 400, so they were losing money on the project when they received $400. The figure was perhaps $625 or whatever. And again, because I last used this example about 3 months ago, I can probably go back and recompute and find the figures aren't off. But the bottom line is the city's savings exceeded whatever loss on paper the department felt they had. They came out ahead in terms of real work done by inmates in their parks, and they saved more than it cost DOC. Measure 17 doesn't talk about saving state agencies money. It saves taxpayers money. That's the context of Measure 17. And so it's not a state government versus local government where you separate the two. You have to look at, was there a net gain for the taxpayers out of something that was done in the community? And I've continually said, when you look at each project, there's been a net gain for the taxpayers, not necessarily for state government. And yes, in essence, the state prison programs, the work programs, are sometimes subsidizing community and local government activities. Fine. Let's own up to that. Let's be proud of it. And let's let everybody know that there was a benefit gain. And again, I won't swear by the figures because I'd have to go back and reconfigure them, but that was the concept.
Well, Ben, Michael, Bill, what's it cost Department of Corrections to send a 10-man work crew into downtown Salem or the outskirts of Salem? I mean, I assume transportation is a component of that, so I'm trying to pick one that isn't very far.
Mr. Chair, we calculate our costs to about $400 a day.
That's what it costs you out of pocket. You got to write a check at the end of the month for $400
yes.
for a 10-man crew.
Yes, sir. The issue that Representative Mannix may be talking about, I'm not quite sure where the $600 figure came from, but out of that $400, there are times when, because of inclement weather, a fluctuation in budgets in the other departments, they simply don't use our crews. So we may be on the hook for a permanently funded position that we have to pay for with no other funding revenue coming in. So that's why in our discussions about funding other fund positions, we need some sort of certitude so we know how much money is going to come in. Otherwise, we can't make an obligation to that employee.
Well, and that's fair, and I agree with exactly what you're saying there, and that unutilized
portion of that supervisor's time probably should be worked in as a variable cost to the amount of time that, or to the bills that he's actually, when he's out in the field. And yet, even if you do that, I'll bet you, you know, whatever that figure ended up being, I'll bet you in terms of value to the taxpayer, not necessarily state agency, there was true value there, or if nothing else, break even.
Mr. Chair, there's absolutely no doubt about that, and we at the department wouldn't dispute that there's a lot of value in doing public works projects, both to the community and to the inmate. And the question is, to what extent will government subsidize it, or what will it take to make it self-supporting? And so we would be in agreement with that statement. There's value in there.
You know, I'm just looking at this thing, and I'm going like, the governor, maybe this is more of a question for Bill, but, you know, the governor took $5.8 million out of this thing, and that seems like a pretty big hit out of one particular department. Was there any rationale on that, or what was the, you know, why should only one area, I guess, of a program be forced to live with a $5.8 million cut?
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, for the record, when the governor announced his budget, he did specifically talk about this reduction. He did say that he wanted to have a discussion session on the role of the inmate work program in terms of its potential competition with the private sector. Both in terms of jobs and businesses. He also wanted to discuss the relative investment of state dollars. And in this case, that he felt that the dollars here were better invested either elsewhere in the department or elsewhere in the budget. We are seeing a significant increase in the other funds revenues that are available for the work program. The crews themselves overall produce a fairly low percentage of the Measure 17 compliance. Not to say that the work that's done is not of value, but from a standpoint of looking at priorities, the governor has made a decision that he felt there were other places to put this money that was more important.
Well, and I guess my question would be, you know, you've taken a very specific cut out of a very specific program to introduce some, you know, to help bring up the discussion of prioritization. My question to you is, what are those priorities? You took the money, it's gone, you hit this program. What are the priorities?
Representative Westland, maybe it would be helpful if I'm not sure I was very clear about exactly where those cuts will be taken in the next budget as far as the work crew supervisors. Would you like me to identify that or something I can hand to Larry? I don't know if you want me to go through that or not.
You have a specific list of priorities?
I have a list of what the impact will be for those reductions.
No, that wasn't the question I was asking. I do want to get into that, but I guess I'm asking more depth here. And I was at the governor's press conference, and he did kind of take on inmate work pretty solid. And as I remember, it was to raise the discussion of, are there other areas we should be spending this money? I guess my question is what are those areas? He says, you know, he wants to prioritize. What are the areas?
Well, Mr. Chair, as you know, there's not a specific put and take where every dollar that's moved from one program moves into another program specifically. And the governor's priorities on education, on juvenile crime prevention, on health, human resources, and overall, this is a budget balancing issue. And when we came to balance the budget, for the set of overall priorities, that this is one that he felt was a low priority. I can't give you a set of specific. We took this $5 million and put it over here. It didn't work that way.
Well, I just wondering. I mean, I guess they take some exception to the governor. I mean, education, higher education, certainly, K-12, he had a fairly modest K-12 budget in his recommended, so, which is where this is, where the first one quoted. Well, I'd be interested to know. I mean, he said he wanted to, you know, key the discussion, and maybe if he just wants folks to discussion on the validity of inmate work. I mean, he's certainly done that. Take this much money out of one program. But if you're going to do that, what's the trade-off? I mean, I'd like to hear the governor's.
Mr. Chair, obviously we're in an awkward position having to advocate for cutting a program that's important to us. But when we take those cuts, What we intend to do is to continue moving forward as quickly as we can. We're making great progress on compliance. That'll be a part of it. The institutions will attempt to backfill with other funds to continue to work crews out there in critical areas. It is true that we're going to have to place a greater priority on people fully funding the projects that they want done. If the city of Salem has a project, because of the pressure on us, they're going to have to pay the $400 a day, or the institutions will have to make up that money someplace else in their budget. So the general approach is that we keep moving ahead, we continue to work in the communities where we can, and we do it with 40 positions fewer.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. Ben can certainly handle this whole load by himself, but sitting in the back, I was struck by a couple of things. This is the debate that's been going on for 5 years over whether or not inmates should be working. Could they, in fact, lower the cost to state government? Private employment possibilities exist. Would they lower the cost to local governments in one way or another? What we are saying through this particular strategy, I didn't come up here to answer the question about what the governor's going to do with the other money. I can't tell you the answer to that. What I can tell you is that DOC is, I think, on the whole, a much greater number of people in the Department of Corrections are committed to making this program work in one way or another. That doesn't mean that everybody's committed to it in the department. There's still a lot of wrangling over whether or not we ought to, as Senator Hannon points out, have non-security staff supervising crews. There are a whole array of questions out there. What we are saying about these other fund positions is if we can, in fact, enter into an agreement with Parks, with the City of Salem, the City of Turner, City of Portland, you name it, we would do that. What we expect, though, is a relationship that's no different than any other contract. We're going to provide a service 200 and some days per year at $400 per day, which is going to be a tax savings to that particular community. But we expect that work to be done and that contract to exist in a way that allows us to hire employees where we're not, in fact, subsidizing them with general fund money when, in fact, they're doing work for communities that benefit from the projects. And if we can get to that kind of relationship, we'll put on 100 crew supervisors. We'll do all kinds of other funded programs if the opportunity exists. The debate will still occur over whether or not a non-security employee of Parks or ODOT or someone else can adequately supervise this crew. And I don't disagree with Senator Hannon that none of us want to read or be in the middle of an event that takes place. But I think this notion that we can protect 100% of the people, 100% of the time, on people who are going to be back in the community in a matter of 1 to 3 years, or in some cases less than that, is an impossible situation. And our correctional officers can't be expected to guarantee that, nor could a Parks employee or ODOT employee. We need to do the training. We need to get the right inmates on those crews, but things are going to happen. And that doesn't excuse the fact that the work needs to occur, because if these folks are going to be successful back in the community, they're going to be successful in part because they've had a chance to learn how to work, something they never knew how to do, how to support themselves, how to support their family, and part of the risk is part of what we're talking about here. And we the DOC, and Ben in particular and some other people, Michael, have worked this thing as hard as they can work it, and we continue to do that. You're not seeing a backing off from the department in terms of the commitment on what we're going to do with work programs.
Mr. Chair, one other point that I think needs to be made here, and I wish Senator Hannon were in the room. The reduction, the 40 FTE reduction, is not related to the need to have other agencies supervise work crews. Senate Bill 773 in the last session gave us that ability to have, it was an efficiency issue, to have certain government entities supervise work crews, parks, military, and so forth, to drive the cost down. So I hope it is clear that we aren't sending poorly trained people from other agencies out in response to a potential in response to cutting our budget.
Well, assuming Senator Hannon gets back, please feel free to.
Okay.
And I think, Mr. Chair, it's certainly possible that there are instances where poorly trained supervisors of crews are out in the community with crews. I don't debate that. And I think we have an obligation to work with those other agencies to ensure the training is adequate, but those other agencies, if they're going to enter that agreement with us and they're going to support these crews, have some obligation to pick the right people, do a little screening on their own. You don't throw the newest hired employee that you just hired on temporary service out to supervise 10 inmates. We don't agree with that. We wouldn't endorse that kind of concept. But I think this is not necessarily a Department of Corrections issue. The state of Oregon, if Representative Manning can remind me, has an obligation to do this work, not just the DOC. This was not focused solely at the DOC as a responsibility to put inmates to work and lower the cost of government.
If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Let me ask Dave a question right there when you get into that particular area.
I'm remembering this, and I might be wrong. Didn't the Income Audit Committee recommend that general fund supplant or support the inmate work program for supervisors?
Mr. Chair, you may be thinking of the Speaker's Council.
I don't know. Some interim group. I don't know if the Audit Committee. I don't know if it was a Public Safety Committee.
Mr. Chair, Larry did the staff work on that.
Who did that?
Chair Westland, committee members, that was an audit done by Legislative Fiscal. Ken Rocco and myself did that audit in support of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. So, yes, that's true. And the basic bottom line recommendation relative to work crews in that report was that the committee adopted this as their recommendation was that the general fund be used to subsidize outside work crew positions so that the cost charged to other agencies using them well below $400 a day. And I provided copies of that report to the committee members on the opening day.
Well, I'm sure I read it. I just must have forgotten since then. Help me out again, because this is coming back to the five-year rule. The Interim Audit Committee recommended that the $400 a day be subsidized. I guess my question to the department is, what's happening to that recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what's happened to the recommendation. I can tell you what's happened to the governor's revised budget. I think the governor's made the decision, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not quite sure how that plays into the...
I think maybe I can answer that a little bit. At the time of the audit, the audit committee sent a response out to the department to respond to that audit report. And their response was they were generally supportive of the recommendation, unable to make a commitment to say could fund it that way because that was a decision ultimately made by the governor. But they were generally supportive of the recommendation. They were so much in support of the recommendation they actually requested funding for subsidizing of those positions in their agency request budget. That's not in the governor's revised budget.
So you were saying yay, and the governor was saying nay, and we're all going to make this work somehow.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
In a nutshell. Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Picking up on what Director Cook had to say, it is important to remember that Measure 17 puts a mandate on all of state government to cooperate with the Department of Corrections in inmate work programs. And that means other agencies need to be actively engaged in this process, looking for opportunities to bring inmates into the agency operations with work programs. Now, the concern about competition in the community has been addressed somewhat by HGR 82. If, to the extent the governor said he wanted to have a debate and have a proposal, that House Joint Resolution came in front of my substantive committee, the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. We've sent it to the floor, passed the House. It's on its way to the Senate. It's in the Senate. There's a couple of slight amendments being made over there. I'm satisfied it will go out to the voters. It will pass resoundingly, as Measure 17 did, as the last tweak to Measure 17 did. And I would say that in that process, then, that the governor has to be recommitted to working to put inmates to work. And we need to revisit the budget priorities because everything that the legislature has said and everything that the voters have said is put these inmates to work. And work crews is one way to do it. In fact, it deals with what I'll call, on the minimum security side, the lower denominator of inmates who haven't yet had a chance to show their work ethic, who haven't developed skills. They get to go out and do pretty basic labor. And over time, they can work their way through this process and get to more advanced jobs. But you got to start somewhere. And in regard to the discussion about the budgetary process, I think the agency has been right on the mark all along, and it's I can say this, it's the governor who needs to be straightened out as far as priorities go.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, would you like me to continue?
Okay. When you send these crews out, do you always send guards and then you supplement with parks and recreation employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, when the crews go out, they're always supervised, and they're supervised either by a DOC employee or sometimes both. Again, these decisions came about as a result of 773, Senate Bill 773, which allowed us to use non-DOC supervisors in certain government entities, other agencies, but the crews are always supervised.
But they're not. You don't always have a prison guard along as routine. You sometimes do, sometimes don't.
That's correct.
How often do you do versus you don't?
Mr. Dave says about 95% of the time is a DOC correctional officer with the crew. It's an exception where you'd have either a military or a parks employee in the supervision role.
Do you supplement with the DOC, or if you send out a DOC, do you supplement with parks, like a park? Do you have more than one supervisor for a crew?
Chairman, it's Representative Minnis. Sure. Let me start over.
Close enough.
Chair Wesson, Representative Minnis, if I'm following your question, the staff assigned can be either DOC staff or host agency staff. In the case that is, for instance, a parks employee, parks as an agency has made a choice that they are willing to send their staff to DOC training so that they may take a DOC inmate crew out to a job site by themselves with their staff to do a day's work and to return them to a DOC facility.
But sometimes they may not have a corrections officer.
That is correct. In that circumstance, they would not have a corrections officer with them.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Representative Minister, again, that was an attempt for us to streamline some of these operations and make them more affordable. It was the belief at the time that some of these crews would have a subject area expert, a parks employee, who would be showing the inmates what work to be done, and then a CO who was there occupied just in case. So it did drive the cost up, so it was a decision by the legislature to permit us to do that.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, these inmates are there because they have a propensity to break the law, and so they don't always want to follow rules. So I don't know that a parks employee has the qualifications to handle somebody that wants to get out in hand. So I have a real concern not only for the safety of the parks employee, but also for the community as a whole.
Well, you know, one of the follow-ups, how many crews have you had out there with non-DOC personnel, and how many incidents have you had?
Mr. Cook has the incidents told.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I think a question came up the other day about the number of incidents that occurred. Let me just give you sort of a rundown of this. I'm coming in okay on your microphone, I assume, if you're waving your arms. 73% of the inmates involved were walk-away situations. There were 40 incidents between May 1, 1998, and April 30th of 1999, so basically 1 year. There were 40 recorded incidents or events. 73% of those were walkaways, as Ben pointed out earlier, from a crew. Essentially, an unauthorized leaving of an inmate from a crew. 13% involved citizen contacts. Essentially, these are girlfriends, whatever, showing up at a crew site, particularly when you work a given location for a prolonged period of time, you know, several days. It becomes pretty obvious that you're going to be back the next day. People are showing up. That could include fights, etc. 7% of those involve inmate-inmate fights. As Representative Minnis pointed out, these are people who generally don't settle their arguments through discourse. 7% involve staff inmate issues, including inmates attempting to assault staff, inmates disobeying orders, etc. 7% would equate to about 3 events during the course of the entire year. And of the total, 3 of the incidents occurred on non Oregon Department of Corrections host agency crews. So a relatively small number of crews that were non-DOC supervised had events, three in total, and those were, should be able to figure out this out from the documents, but I don't know that I can. Yeah, there was an inmate fight on a hosted crew. There was an inmate fight. There was, in two cases, there were walkaways. So of the three that occurred, two were walkaways, one was a fight.
And that was out of how many total? 71?
Out of a total of 40.
40.
We've continued to decline in terms of the numbers. In 1995, we had something in the neighborhood of 50, and we've gone down every year. We have a very aggressive fugitive apprehension unit, so the risk of taking off is increased by the number of people that get apprehended again shortly thereafter. But these are people that, thinking further down the road in many cases in a week is unusual, and the thought that you're going to get home early by walking away is pretty appealing in some cases. So it does happen about one per week.
And again, Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we really have to take a look at now is the quality and the effectiveness of the training to the non-DOC people, and it's time after a year to sit down and assess that effectiveness. We're very concerned that if we have a non-DOC supervisor involved with a crew, that person feel comfortable. We've had incidents, I'm sure you're aware of, where people have felt compelled, felt in danger, and our belief is that if we perceive a situation that way, that's something that we need to address. So one of the things, and we obviously can't exert total control over somebody else's department, but we certainly can sit down with the leadership and say, what are your staff saying, what's the effectiveness of the training, what can we do to make this work, and to make sure that it's safe.
Mr. Chair, there's another issue here, too, I think, around walkaways that doesn't always get addressed. Those of you other than Mr. Chair, the situation with walkaways, I think, is one where the DOC's got some increasing responsibility to know the behavior of inmates, and I don't know how you get at this with 9,000 inmates or the 1,000 or so that are out on cruise at any given time, but the issue becomes walkaways occur for a variety of reasons, normally around things that have happened at home, events with a wife, girlfriend, whatever the case might be, boyfriend. People, I think, can in part be identified as potential walkaways. That's helped us to reduce some of the reduction. Some of the reduction comes from the fact that there's a likelihood they're going to get apprehended again shortly after they leave or within a matter of several weeks anyway. There are some things we can do to prevent that, but again, thinking errors are what got people in this situation. Some level of tolerance for walkaways, I think, is accepted around the work program. If we ever get to the point of saying that we won't tolerate any event, any walkaway, any activity, we will not have any minimum custody crews. We'll simply be prohibited from that. I think the big mistake there, and as Representative Minnis pointed out, there's no tolerable risk, but the big mistake is that, again, you've got people who are going back in the community. They're going to be there in a matter of 6 months or a year. Sort of de-escalation of supervision over a period of time, introducing people back into a community setting, isn't an all bad situation. It's going to be risky. It's going to have downside because you're going to have failures in that. But it's also unrealistic to assume the day the door pops open, they leave, that they are now ready for success in the community with no experience in that. That's probably not realistic either. So the blending of this is kind of a challenge.
Have you retrieved all those that have walked away?
No, we don't retrieve all of them, Representative Minnis, but we do have a higher capture rate than we have loss rate. And over a matter of another few years, I suspect we'll be in a position where there will not be a whole lot of people left out on escape status. But at one point, 5 or 6 years ago, the DOC had maybe 1,000 or more people who were in that status. And we are becoming more and more successful at it.
Of these that have walked away, how many are still?
Of the ones from last year, of the 27 that walked away, I can't tell you. My assumption would be that probably half to two-thirds have been apprehended, maybe more than that. It could be that all 27 are still on the case status, though. That's not the case, but it could be.
Did you get that?
Yeah, we'll have to know of those 27 how many were apprehended in the day that it was.
Thank you.
Representative Manager, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to put this 40 incidents in context. In that 1 year time frame, do you know how many hours of work were put in by inmates in the field?
Do you have personnel? We do.
Okay.
Okay. So that, well, let's see. Work, for example, represents Manic from 731 of 97 to the following 731 of 98. 228,000, almost 229,000 hours at one set of institutions, Mill Creek and Shutter Creek. Powder River for the same period, about 75,000. CRCI. How come I have two formulas, Michael, on that one? You pick either one, I guess. About anywhere between 60 and 90,000 hours, depending on how you count it. And for Shutter Creek Correctional, about 71,000 hours. So I think we're probably pushing about 450,000 hours, 500,000, half a million hours. We had 27 walkaways and 13 other incidents. They're different calendar dates, but that ratio would occur at about the same rate regardless of when you were talking about.
So this is an incident rate of about one incident for 10,000 hours of inmate work.
Yeah, probably a greater ratio than that, but that's certainly close.
And of that, say it's one incident for 10,000 hours of inmate work, this is the outside work.
Yes.
We know that 3/4 of these were walkaways, which means nobody was harmed. I assume that means nobody was harmed. So that leaves us 1 in 40,000 hours involving something other than a walkaway. Of the 1 in 40,000 hours, it looks like half of those were citizen contacts with a girlfriend or boyfriend, and the other half was either an inmate-inmate fight or a staff-inmate issue.
That's correct, Representative Nate. That would amount to 6 incidents that were some sort of physical confrontation that probably, in the case of staff inmates, didn't include actual assaults, but I think attempts to assault or intimidate.
6 incidents out of about 450,000 hours of inmate work, which maybe comes to 1 incident for every 70,000 hours of inmate work. I wonder if we could get an equivalent ratio for a Boy Scout camp.
Or a junior high school.
I'm just trying to point out your incident rate. Now, I assume your folks, if I may, Mr. Chairman, your folks are supposed to report any incidents and document them.
That's correct.
Now, have we had any incidents where, in all this work, a civilian or an agency person, we've had 3 staff inmate issues. That sounds like an agency person may have been harmed. Has there been any harm?
It would have been, Representative Nance, it would have been an ODOT or Oregon Department of Corrections employee. I cannot tell you whether there was an actual assault that took place because the information is categorized as including attempts to assault staff, inmates disobeying orders, and staff assaulting inmates.
You mentioned, if I may pursue this, you mentioned 3 incidents that occurred with non-DOC supervisors. One was an inmate fight, so that obviously did not hurt the agency person, and 2 walkaway.
That's correct.
So the non-DOC supervisors, there's been no harm to their people.
That's correct.
And in all these statistics you gave me, has there been any harm to a citizen?
In the incidents, Representative Mannix, that I gave you, I'm not aware of any. There have been citizens harmed by property loss in the past from walkaways at Powder River.
Later on.
After the fact, correct.
I'm talking about first.
After
you should have
the event.
The immediate context, and then the general, once they're out there, they may be committing other crimes.
The data is not good, Representative Manning. It's good enough to tell you whether or not something occurred right at that time. We can find that out.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to pursue is a sense of security as to are we choosing the right people to go out there. We need to remember, too, that I'd be interested to see what the average amount of remaining sentences these inmates have, because at some point they're going to be totally free of supervision other than the alleged supervision. I want to be careful here. We have fine parole and probation officers, but with the ratio of people they have to supervise, usually they have to spend all their time watching sex offenders and major violent criminals, not your minimum security inmates.
By way of anecdote, I can tell you that the one I can remember being the most amazing to me was somebody who had about 6 weeks left on their sentence who did a walkaway. Typically, you're going to have it anywhere from 1 to 2 years to probably just having come to minimum custody, but it's pretty unusual, something that's as close as 5 or 6 or 8 weeks away to have that occur. More typical that they're a year plus away from release, and an event occurs where they feel like they have to go intervene in that event.
Final question. So trying to balance this out, as opposed to chain gangs and shotguns and or other firearms and posting all kinds of security, we have a system where it's not too hard for an inmate who wants to walk away, then you'll aggressively try to bring him back. But your risk assessment was such that at some point this person is going to be out there again anyway, and your criminal history is such that if they walk away, you're not going to step in and use egregious force to prevent them from walking away at the time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mays, I worry about the criminal history. There's no question about that. I think that's why Mr. Harkins and others who represent security very clearly have concerns about the criminal history. This is a situation in Oregon where 95-96% of those people are going back to the community, as you well know, and a third of them will fail within 3 years. Two-thirds will be relatively successful, depending on how you count the stages. But the fact is that under Oregon classification systems, under criminal law, they're going to be released. We're doing our best to give them the skills and some experience out in the communities before they actually go there, expecting them to behave properly. Some are going to leave, some are going to go home and assault their wives, girlfriends, fathers, whatever the case might be, and come back pretty darn quickly. But on the whole, Oregon has good success with this type of a program. We have a good track record with host agency supervision and with DOC supervision. Where we can improve is on the training, as Ben said earlier, when we've attempted to do that. Where we can improve, I think, is on knowing a little bit more about whether an inmate, due to an event at home, a death of a family member, whatever, has a greater likelihood they may be leaving. If we could know that information, we would intervene. More often than not, we don't know the information until it's too late.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one more. Okay. I realize I've been jumping in a lot here, but if we wanted to take a step back and figure out what's the best thing to do here, the outside work crews is really not the most substantial element of the inmate work program, and maybe we'll start focusing in an area that is an area of relatively minor significance. And is it not smarter, perhaps, to invest in having, think about this, a corrections officer with every crew to allay agency concerns, go to that expense, and then not sweat that and just say, maybe we're spending more than we need to, but we're being super safe, because we don't want to risk, as Senator Hanna said, the operation getting a bad name. And we want to make sure that there's good people in charge. And yes, it's going to cost a little extra money, but in the cosmic scheme of things, it's a good investment.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Manning, I think you may have hit it on the head in one respect, that we can calculate the numbers and look at prevalence. The bottom line is that people are feeling that they're unsafe. It doesn't do any good to go through and say, well, statistically, the odds of your getting hurt are very low, like flying in an airplane and so forth. I won't bore you with the details. But I think you're absolutely right. It's most visible, although one of the smallest, it's one of the most visible aspects of the inmate work program.
I have a slightly different take on that. I agree with what Ben is saying in terms of the perception of the public and the parks employees and others. I think there is a strong likelihood that you create a very false sense of security simply by putting the correctional officer with that crew. I don't think that's the complete resolution. I think most correctional officers would tell you that they do a very good job. I agree with that. They know what to look for. They have some skills that others don't. But they are going to lose people. They are going to have events occur. And I think you're going to say to DOC, well, now that you've got DOC people on there, no level of escape is tolerated. We expect perfection, and I think that's unrealistic to expect the correctional officers to have that level of intuitive knowledge that's going to protect against that from occurring.
One more. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, then, this is important because I think if we're going to – I had been talking to Representative Minnis on the side, and I always sort of visualize we had one corrections officer who would come supplemental support. But maybe that's the way to go, is you say to the agencies, we're going to provide this special certification so we have more interaction with people who know what they're doing, but there will always be a corrections officer on the scene. And whether it's cost-effective in a given minute instance, generally speaking, it's good policy, because when you have two people who are supervising,
you've actually probably 4 to 6 times as much effective security supervision just from that other human being. It's not just 1 plus 1. There's a multiplication effect. And that's something we need to think about, too, in this process.
Representative Mays, and Mr. Chair, I didn't come up here to disagree with you, and I think that your knowledge about this is as great as anyone's. However, part of the reason that we do get some of the initial work we get is because the costs are more than competitive. We demonstrate that we're very successful, people want us back, and they appreciate and value the work. When you add 2 people to that crew, you begin to make the high school crew, some other kind of crew, at least as competitive, or not more competitive with us fiscally. So I think there's a balancing act here that we've tried to consider in this process, which is we agree with the safety being the number one issue. On the other hand, if we're priced out of the marketplace, we never get the potential to demonstrate the quality of the work that we do. We don't get the first base in terms of the jobs, because if you're Turner and you can hire a work crew that's high school kids during the summer for 2/3 of the cost of an ODOT crew, then we're out of the biz. And that's not helpful either.
It's true.
Senator Hinn.
James, what would occur if you had an inmate or a corrections officer scheduled to go out with an inmate crew and work, and something happened where the corrections officer was sick or because of a leave of absence or emergency in his family or her family? Do you have enough adequate backup staff to say we're still going to send the work crew out regardless?
Mr. Chair,
if somebody's sick or unable to work that day?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think you could find all sorts of things occurring. There could, in fact, be a backup Oregon Department of Corrections employee that goes. The crew could be canceled for the given day. The crew time could be reset for another day.
What I'm trying to get at is following up on Representative Manning's question about sending a corrections officer on each work crew. What would we run into if something happened to that person on that particular given day? There was a death in his family or something, and could have. Would the work crew still go out, but with a lesser person?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I'm not sure I can answer the question except from the way that we're doing it currently, which is you may only have a ODOC employee acting as the crew supervisor and nobody else. In that case, the crew might get canceled. It might be reset. In the case where you had 2 people involved in it, and your direction to us was that we were going to have an ODOC security person and the other agency employee on the crew, we would not send the crew out if that were the direction. We're now, and we may not be getting at your answer, I may not be getting at your answer, but we're
not. No, I'm just trying to find out because, Mr. Chairman, one last question here, and maybe this ought to be at Bill McGee. The elimination of the 40 work crew supervisors,
yes,
was that a governor's revised budget that eliminated those positions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, no, that was in the governor's original budget.
It was in the governor's original budget.
Yes, sir.
And how much impact in the ballot measure, ballot measure 17 work program going to be affected by the elimination of these 40 work group supervisors? Do you have a breakdown that says we used to do this much, but now we can only do this much?
The department had that information for you. The work crews are not the largest piece of the compliance.
Are these work crews outside the institutions rather than work crews in the institutions?
Mr. Chair, of the 40 positions, 19 are crews that work supervise crews inside the institutions. 11 are dedicated to parks, 2 are dedicated to military, so 13 are outside, and 8 of them are vacant. They're farm positions that were switched to other funds from general fund during the current biennium and have not been filled.
Okay.
I could call up on Senator Hannon's question, too. I'd ask that question as well. What was the impact on the ability to comply with that 17? And although I don't have the percentage, I think the answer was in short that it would idle about 284 inmates. So it would otherwise be out working.
Is that a fair, accurate number?
I'm
that a fair accurate number, about 284 inmates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I would say so, although what's more difficult to predict is to what extent will we pick up responsibilities for work crews with other positions as well. It doesn't mean necessarily because the positions are gone that we're going to stop certain activity. There will be some redistribution of the workload, and we will continue to move forward towards our Measure 17 compliance. So it's very difficult to say exactly how all that will shake out.
Okay.
I think if I may qualify too, I think to some extent it really depends on what Ben already testified to, which is the level of ability to get commitments from customers to fund the outside workforce. If they don't have the commitment and the advance notice, the department's not in a good position to fill the positions and have them ready to go out on a work crew, in which case it will be hard to get revenue generated to support those crews. On that point,
wouldn't it be a good idea then? You've got, say, Parks and Recreation, and they make an institutional commitment for the biennium, and then it's a matter of scheduling and arranging it with the proper security. And if it's bad weather, you say, well, this is a bad day for blazing this trail, but we'll understand that you can reschedule. Or if the DOC officer is ill that day, there should be another DOC officer prepared to step in and be sent out. So you have continuity, but if anything, it ought to be the weather that prevents the projects rather than personnel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it's absolutely critical from our perspective, as we rely more on other funds here, that continuity be in place. One of the things that we don't do very well is gear up and then change plans. It's very, very difficult for us in this regard. So if we could have a 12-month contract or a 24-month contract, we'd at least be able to do our financial planning and be able to do it that way.
And at the same time, one of the other costs associated with this, I mean, there's the supervision of the inmate work crew. Sometimes you need a supervisor of work, which costs additional dollars.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In the technical area particularly, if you're dealing with something that you need subject area expertise, you'd have to have more than security people there.
And what percent of the work gets into subject area expertise, as you call it?
That's, Mr. Chair, something I'd have to check on for you.
It's not very much, I'm assuming.
Half? We're guessing half.
That's a higher percentage than I would guess. And what's that run? I mean, round numbers. Because now we're moving from $400, to $400 plus. What's the subject area expertise?
In stream remediation, probably in a whole array of areas where you have people with technical skills, but as we totaled up when you had been out of the room for a minute, it's about 500,000 hours of crew time annually that's out there, inmate hours worked. And so you can assume that a significant percentage of them on certain parks, projects, or military skills that the crew does not have. Painting or whatever the case might be, typically I suppose our people are on top of that, but there may be some more high-level skills, construction skills that need some direction initially.
But half a million
hours may require some technical expertise to ensure that it occurs properly.
And Mr. Chair, some of that expertise we can accomplish by having someone come out and consult for an hour, lay the job out, for example, and then come back later in the day. And depending on the project, you may have someone who has to be there the entire time. So there's a lot of variability.
I was thinking you could have some job-specific supervisors, but God, how do you anticipate that?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to call it quits for the day. We appreciate your attendance.
I can't believe people didn't say after the gun bill.
Do you want to hear more on this tomorrow?
I think we've got a couple other aspects of inmate work other than just, good job, Rob. Anyway, so we will adjourn for the day and continue tomorrow.
Thank you.